All right. So, Buddha's practice is very much about finding peace within. And as I was talking about last night at the Greenpoint meeting, the mind is very much, while there's always parts of the mind that are where peace is available, generally we're not aware of it. Because the mind is very much, the brain is very much set up to monitor what's going on in the world, to keep flowing out and keep track of all the different stories, obligations, responsibilities, external events that are going on, and looking for lasting sense of happiness out there in the world. And because there's our minds tend to jump around from one subject to another, often external, we don't become aware of the tranquility and peace that's actually available with us within. Why? Because tranquility and peace are parts of the mind that are not especially very loud or noticeable. They're not the parts of the mind that are like a marching band with, you know, tubas and big, what are the fucking drums they carry? Marching drums. Cymbals, marching drums. That's the fear, Bhayapada and Kamachada. The fear and anger are the loud parts of the mind which shout and yell and want your attention. And so when we're jumping about and always externally focused, we generally tend to hear either the thoughts that are the most worried or anxious or angry, or B, we listen to the thoughts that tend to overpromise what they can deliver, like the politicians that get on a lot of coverage by the media because they promise things that they can't possibly fulfill. There are thoughts in the mind like worrying about the future that would have you believe, oh, if I listen to my worrying, that I could somehow figure out all the bad shit that's going to happen and avoid it somehow. The problem is, if you're anything like me, you probably haven't yet figured out how to know what's going to happen in the future. It's all a big lie, a sham. You're not actually able to figure it out. If you figured out, you know, the 1,000 worst things that could possibly happen, it'll always be the 1,002nd that you didn't figure out that'll actually occur. That's just generally the way life works out. We don't generally tend to know exactly the way bad shit's going to happen, even though the mind continually wants to try to figure out how the shit's going to hit the fan. So we tend to try to figure out how we can play through things, and then there's obsession with things that have gone wrong in life, relationships that have faltered, jobs that haven't turned out quite as we wanted them, projects that aren't working out. So basically, in all these situations, the mind is focusing on things it has absolutely no control over, can't change, nothing can be done about them. And what the mind then tends to do is flow out into the world, into the external experience, looking for an answer. This constantly jumping around outside, abandoning our inner experience and looking out into the world for a person, a thing, something to believe in that will give us all the answers, including, you know, Buddhism and everything. Just give me the one simple thing that I can, you know, cling onto and just memorize the, you know, as long as I can have that, I'll be great. Just give it to me. This flowing out, also looking for dangers, the one threat, if we think we can get rid of this one person, this one problem in our lives, if I just didn't have this one thing, I could just be happy, and that would be, everything would be great. So this idea that if we just change or get something in the world or in our lives, everything will be solved, that we would never have to suffer again, despite the fact that life has inevitable frustrations. We're all going to grow old, we're all going to get sick, we're all going to die, yippee, we're all going to be separated at times from the things we love, we're all going to experience rejection, we're all going to go through a feeling of not getting the kind of attention and love that we want from other people. These are the things that happen in life. It's what it means to be born into a human body, but the mind likes to think that there's something out there that if I consume it, grab it, have it, know what it is, that somehow I will be immune to pain. I will not have to go through frustration or pain. So just tell me what, or give me that one thing and everything will be great. So this is what is called udaka. The mind is anxious, jumping around, looking for that one thing. And because it's constantly jumping, we don't know that there's actually very much present in our lives a solution, which is an inside peace that comes about through developing and cultivating this very quiet part of the mind that happens when we're not lost in our fears, our obsessions, our inner monologue about ourself, our inner biographies, our commentaries on the world, all the things that add to this underlying noise that doesn't allow us to see the true peace which is available to us. So this flowing out and jumping about, the Buddha called the asavas. And he had a teaching called the subasavas, which means cleverly how to get rid of the asavas. And the asavas are the jumping mind that flow out constantly looking for the answer out there. The Buddha said that there was three kinds of asavas, kamasava, bhavasava, and avijasava, none of which you're required to know and don't even bother to worry about them. I'm going to tell you what they mean. I just like the Pali. I like to keep track of it. Kamasava means we are looking out in the world for something to answer all of our inner stress. We're trying to find something that will make pain go away, will make loneliness go away, will make boredom go away, will make rejection go away, will make that feeling of there's something missing in me going away. We're trying to find the answer out there. Just give it to me in drugs, my career, my friendships, my Facebook, my relationship. Just give me that thing and I will never have to feel pain or loneliness ever again. And so we look for it. And the next thing is bhavasava, which means we are also craving for more and more life and experiences with the idea that, oh, if only I got to live to 300 and got to travel the world and backpack in Indonesia and a backpack in the mountains and lie on the beach in Indonesia. I have no clue what I'm talking about. But if we have all this more life experience, somehow just the experiences and the living more, then inevitably I'll find the answer. It's just a matter of just give me, thrust into me as much life as possible, and somehow in there I will find peace just by experiencing as many things as I possibly can experience. And then finally there's avijasava, which is the idea if I can figure out who I really am, if I can get to know the real me, find out my true inner identity, nail my inner autobiography, really come up with that core missing truth of who I am that defines me, then everything will be okay. It's all me. I just really have to know me really well, and then me will never have to suffer again because me knows who me really is, and somehow that will answer everything. It's just I don't know who the true me is, and that's why I'm still suffering. By the way, the answer to why the last one is problematical is because the Buddha, quite ahead of his time before all of modern psychology and philosophy, realized that there is no core lasting identity. We're always subtly changing. Who we are is a matter of how we use our minds. As neuroscientists say, neurons that fire together, wire together. The way we use the brain changes the brain. The brain is constantly rewiring itself. The thoughts that we're experiencing are constantly changing. The gut feelings and sensations are changing. So there is no core me, no core you. There are tendencies we all have, but there is no lasting definition. And that amount of time we spend trying to figure out what my core truth is time that we waste looking in the wrong direction and get more and more stressed out, because no matter what we find, there's always something about us that doesn't quite fit. If I think, oh, I'm such a smarty pants, I guarantee you the next day I'm going to say the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life, and then my entire sense of who I am is blown. Because either that's not me who said the idiotic thing, or the way I've defined myself is wrong. So this idea of self-definition being the answer is not the correct one. So how do we get out of this habit of the mind jumping around looking for the answer outside of me? How do we keep the mind settled and develop peace in our lives while we still have to be in the world? The Buddha came up with a bunch of tools. The first is known as Ayonisa Manasikara. Again, don't memorize that or don't write it down. It just means appropriate attention to your thoughts and see which thoughts are bringing stress into your life and which thoughts are bringing clarity. The Buddha said that there are certain types of thoughts that we all like to think, thinking they'll be the solution for everything, that actually do not bring anything other than a waste of mind and a confusion. The Buddha, I'm going to quote from him tonight, because there's some really wonderful teachings in this sutta. Unskillful ideas arise. What was I like in the past? Who was I in the past? What will become of me in the future? What will I be like in the future? How will I be in relation to other people? One becomes perplexed about oneself in the present. Who am I? How am I? Where have I come from? Where has the cosmos come from? Where are we all bound? You get the idea. There are these thoughts that we try to find the answer for everything to. We want to have a little explanation. We think by knowing intellectually something that somehow that will give us the key to answering why we're here. What's the whole purpose? At this point, I should give you some pretty interesting news, which is that Buddhism is not a path that has a god in it, and therefore there is no predetermined purpose that you haven't discovered yet for your life. We all like to say, I'm trying to discover my true me or discover my purpose. There is no predetermined purpose. We're all born pretty much with one thing in mind in terms of Darwin, which is just to keep the species going. That's not a great purpose, right? So the purpose of our lives is something that we define for ourselves. It's not something we unearthed that was predetermined. It's something that we create through our own actions and how we use our mind. There's nothing waiting for you to discover. What's waiting is for you to develop your own purpose, and it can be anything. There's nothing that defines you, nothing that limits you. There's nothing that you have to be in line with. All you have to do is say, okay, this type of action makes me feel good about myself. It gives me a good feeling about why I'm here. I'm going to do that. And that becomes your purpose. That becomes who you are. Your actions determine who you are, not the opposite. Who you are does not determine your actions. So I'm getting heavy here, so I'm just going to keep moving. The idea is to see which thoughts are just leading you in the wrong direction, trying to trick you into thinking that, oh, if I only had the right bit of knowledge, that everything would be okay. I just have to figure out this one answer, this one intellectual puzzle. If I get it, it'll all be done. That's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. The best thoughts that are useful, that bring clarity, are thoughts of gratitude for the skillful things you've done and skillful things that other people have done, generosity, appreciation for the times that we've been virtuous, that we haven't caused harm to other beings, that we've in fact been compassionate with other people. These are the things that will be important to us when we go through the later stages, when death is near, when we look back on our lives. We won't look back and say, oh, remember the time I bought my iPad? That was great. I hope we won't. Rather, I think we'll focus on the times we were close to other people and caring, and when we gave of ourselves, and when we shared, and when we truly drank in life's experiences and didn't have all that underlying monologue obscuring being truly present. So The second factor, after learning to see which thoughts are skillful and which thoughts are just leading us in the wrong directions, is avaroditta, which is restraining the senses, learning which senses are leading the mind in the wrong direction. There was, the Buddha uses the example of if you see something that's just grossly disturbing, that's not going to bring you any wisdom or any clarity, that's just there just disturbing you, there's other senses that you can focus your awareness on. If any of you ever watch a TV show, Louie, there's a show where he's watching a guy play a beautiful violin in the subway, and then a homeless person comes and washes his ass. And so he keeps on trying to focus on the classical musician, but his mind keeps bringing him back to watching this old homeless guy washing his ass with soap. So the idea is not to ignore the fact that there's suffering, homelessness, and that there's lots of things in the world to be addressed. In fact, the idea is to the degree we can, work on these things. But to the extent that the mind loves to, I'm not really talking about like the things in the life that are going in the world that are wrong. It's more that the mind loves to focus on the one person in a room that's, you know, maybe not laughing at our jokes, or the one person who doesn't seem to like us, or the one person who's doing something that we find irritating. The mind tends to always flood in the direction where there's stress and where there's drama. And if we can learn to use the mind skillfully so that we see it, note it, and then bring our awareness to other senses. If I'm constantly focused on what's going on in sight, I can also remember that there's hearing, there's touch, there's taste, there's other senses that I can balance my awareness with. I just don't have to be focused visually on that one person who I find irritating. Not that they're here or there. Suggest, never mind. All right, so when I'm getting tattooed, I like, rather than try to imagine that the pain's not there, I do remember to breathe, to hear, to see, so that I'm not just feeling the sensation of getting a tattoo. I had one time when I was passing a kidney stone, which is, you might have heard, painful, and I didn't have any medication or drugs. I just had to do it by focusing awareness in the pain, trying to find the center of it, and then focusing the mind away to what was going on around me, feeling the breath, feeling the sensation of the breeze, feeling what it felt like to, you know, other parts of the body. This is using the mind skillfully. We don't have to allow the mind to tug us wherever it wants to go. We can practice in every situation in life. We can practice, okay, I'm in a subway, there's something really disturbing going on over there. There's, you know, somebody, you know, vomiting or whatever, you know. I can focus the mind on, well, probably not the breath, that wouldn't be the best thing, but you can focus the mind on breathing or on, you know, another sensation, maybe just feeling the sensation of yourself sitting or whatever. You get the idea. So the third tool is using the requisites responsibly. By this, the Buddha meant that all people need food, clothing, shelter, medication, and most of us who are not monks need also a job, a career. So let's say there's five requisites, right? We all need to have these things. So, you know, we need food. Now the point is, before Buddhism, a lot of people tried to practice inner awareness by giving up or eating as little as possible so that they literally were virtually starving themselves to death. And the Buddha rejected this. He said that what we should do is eat to the extent that we can feel comfortable and practice, but not to the point that we're trying to get our happiness or change our moods through food or through our clothing or through shopping or through our careers. We use these things responsibly We give them the amount of appropriate attention and focus they're due, but we don't become addictive about them. Because if we become addictive about one area of our lives, we're training the mind to flow into things, looking for the answer out there, rather than to keep any inwards awareness. So the Buddha, let me quote him exactly. Reflecting appropriately, one wears clothing for protection against the weather and for being comfortable, but not towards excessive beautification. And I would add the feel of spending money on my credit card. You know, people can get very addicted to shopping, just buying something. For me, that word sale, even if I totally didn't need the thing, the fact that it was marked down from $30 to $15 makes my mind go, oh, I better pay attention to this. And I really have to remember, nope, not going there, not trying to kill the boredom right now with the shopping, not trying to kill the fact that I'm really angry at somebody at work, or I'm frustrated with this situation by shopping, or that I'm upset or whatever with, no, just using it appropriately. One eats not to intoxicate, but to survive in a healthy manner and to support one's skillful endeavors. Obviously, we want to be healthy so that we can practice, so that we can earn our living appropriately, so we can help and be attentive and happy in life. One uses lodging for protection against the inclemencies of the weather and enjoyment of seclusion. And one uses medicine solely for curing disease. And I would include in curing disease, obviously, mental illness is very much a disease too. So it's not just physical ailments, but obviously if your doctor has prescribed antidepressants or whatever, that's totally appropriate. The idea is, though, to use things to the degree that they are helpful in sustaining life and making ourselves capable of having skillful endeavors in our life, but not to the point where we're trying to get our happiness from these areas, from shopping, from eating, from, you know, drinking, from whatever. The moment these become solutions in life, other than means to an end, we're sort of in trouble. The fourth tool is tolerating life's inevitable discomforts. And what are the discomforts to be abandoned by tolerating? One tolerates cold, heat, hunger, flies, mosquitoes, ill-spoken, unwelcome words. That's the majority of them, right? I mean, you might as well throw out the mosquitoes and it's just like the shitty things that people say and do. Let's just get right to that, Buddha. Okay. Bodily feelings when they arise. He probably means gas, right? And the disagreeable and displeasing events in the world. And what he means is there's, to a certain degree, there's always been unskillful people and always been really unskillful things in the world. The most important thing to do is to see that there's so much we can do to bring ourselves happiness, but to a certain amount of time, the most of our suffering is caused by this idea that there shouldn't be any frustrations in life, that there shouldn't be any mosquito bites, that there shouldn't be any displeasing words, that we shouldn't ever have to be around anybody who acts unskillfully. When this is the way the world has always been, the best we can do is change as much we can. But if we get in this thing where every single time somebody does something unskillful, our brains get set off with an inner dialogue of how awful this is and how could this person do this, and repeating the words in our mind over and over again, we're not solving anything. We're not making it go away. All we're doing is repeating the stress and suffering experience over and over and over again. The Buddha used the analogy, famous teaching, when he's with a monk, and a young monk, and he's just taught the monk about the rule against touching women and women touching men if they're monks. And so he's walking, after he finishes his lesson, there's a woman who's very old and trying to cross the stream, and the Buddha abandons the monk for a second, lifts the woman across the stream and deposits her on the other side, walks across the stream and then continues the conversation as if nothing has happened. And the monk says a half an hour later, "Well, I just got to ask you because it's been bothering me. You just told me about touching a woman or, you know, any member of the opposite sex, and then you just lifted that woman across the stream and came back. What's going on?" And the Buddha said, "Well, I put her down a half an hour ago. You're still carrying her." What that means is the monk is still carrying the story around in his mind, repeating it. Or another example, the Buddha has the first arrow and the second arrow. When people insult us or do something that causes us harm, they shoot us with an arrow. But then the second and third and fourth and fifth arrows, we shoot into ourselves by saying, "How could that person have done that? They're just as unskillful as they accuse me of being. In fact, they're worse. In fact, I can't wait till I see them again, and I'm going to remind them of the time that they did A, B, C, D." That's shooting the arrow into our own experience. So what we do instead is we learn to tolerate by simply seeing that being alive means experiencing a certain amount of mosquito bites from actual mosquitoes and from people. We see that this is what it's like, and rather than trying to figure out a way to make it all go away, we simply say, "Okay, this is not where my happiness is. I'm going to focus my mind on where true happiness is." Rather than mulling over that person who's insulted or rejected me or done something frustrating, I'm not going to give them the satisfaction by causing more suffering for myself. I'm going to focus my mind on where true peace is available. So the fifth tool is avoiding dangers that could cause harm. So while we tolerate the little things that are not going to cause harm, we learn to avoid, and this is Paravajjhati. And what things should we abandon by avoiding, the Buddha says? We reflect appropriately. We avoid wild elephants, bulls, snakes. So far, I think you're all in good shape. Cliffs. Avoid cliffs. One avoids unsuitable habitats and associating with the sorts of ignorant people that would make us do things we regret. So there comes a time when you see that somebody is so unskillful or doing things that are so harmful that we learn to not hang out with them. This is a time where we have to avoid this person. They're no longer just doing things that are irritating. They're creating a situation where it's inevitable that I'm going to do something that I regret. You know, if you hang around people that are constantly doing drugs or getting into scrapes that are dangerous, who are, you know, I don't know, whatever, just doing things that you know are shameful, and while they're doing that, stay away. Stay away from the things that are going to inevitably result in things that we find shameful or that are going to cause a sense of despair or a sense of a loss of self-esteem. And finally, for tonight, eliminating those harmful intentions, the idea that when something goes wrong in our lives or there's a frustration, if only I could get rid of this one person, get rid of this one thing in my life, if only I could zap them out of existence. That energy that we bring, that mental preoccupation, brings so much unnecessary stress and suffering into our lives. I was telling the story a few weeks ago. There was somebody who I was assigned to work with, who several months ago had done something or had been very difficult, I found. And I hadn't really thought about this person in the interim, but then when I was reassigned to work with them, my mind retold the whole story. And I went into the interaction with them feeling like, "Oh, shit, this is going to be really bad." And my mind just, like, prepared, and I got physically tense, and I got completely contracted, and I've got armed with like all the things that I was going to say to put them in their place. And while they were in the room, I was
you know.
And then I realized that they hadn't said or done anything this time, that everything had been in the past, and at this point they were acting perfectly reasonable. Now, the expectation that they might do something, you know, idiotic, they might very well in the future, but being guarded and trying to figure out a way to make them go away and using my mind to try to zap out of existence, you know, other people is not a good use of my mind. So I realized I have to ignore this unskillful mind state and instead focus on A, remembering, seeing that they're not doing anything, reflecting that this person, getting rid of them out of my life, is not going to bring me any additional happiness. Wanting them not to be in the same building with me is not really going to solve anything, because then my mind will find somebody else at that job to not like. Turns out the way the mind works, when we try to get rid of one thing or one person, and you actually do get rid of them, then somebody else pops up in their place. And amazingly enough, here's another thing about the mind. When there's that one thing that if you could only get that one thing, then you get it, then there's always one more thing that you need. You get that new iPod 2. And then they announce there's an iPod 3. Fuck them. I just bought this iPod 2. This is supposed to be the solution for everything. This thing has got a camera on both sides. What else do I need? Oh, shit, now this thing does the other thing that this thing doesn't. Why the fuck did I buy this when I could have had that? So it turns out everything externally that we flow out onto, for it to be the solution, there's always going to be that one more thing. And that one person or thing that if we could only get rid of that roommate, that coworker, that job, that situation in life, if only I didn't have this back pain, blah, blah, it turns out nothing makes inevitable pain go away. What works is learning to focus the mind within, practice developing peace within, practice cultivating skillful thoughts so that we're not always trapped by the world, that we have another source within where we can find peace. So I hope you got something from tonight's teaching, a bunch of tools from the Sabhasava Sutta. Next week is going to be the last tool, which is a whole world in and of itself. It's called the Seven Factors of Awakening, and it's a wonderful set of tools in and of themselves. So I thank you for listening, and now it's your turn to share anything that you'd like to share about spiritual practice. So thank you for listening. Any thoughts, questions? Hey.
Right. So...